Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas and Go at the Y, and Gas and Go at Mill Bay.
It's nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station. We're broadcasting from up here on snowy Signal Hill, where it's up to 32 degrees. 30 degrees out at the airport, where they're experiencing a snow-freezing fog. They're expecting the snow to continue until 3 p.m. anyway, and then turn to rain and snow. High near 35 today, with light and variable winds turning to the east to 20, could gust as high as 30. Rain tonight too, mainly before midnight. South winds to 10, turning to the west to 25 after midnight. Coming up on the Midday Report, N95 masks are in town, but limited supply. Alaska's congressional delegation made the case for the infrastructure law on Friday. And for the second year in a row, the Yukon Quest will not run the traditional 1,000-mile race.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. and Germany are both warning that Russian military aggression against Ukraine will be met with costly sanctions against Russia. Here's President Biden.
Germany and the United States, together with our allies and partners, are working closely together to pursue diplomatic resolutions of this situation. And diplomacy is the very best way forward for all sides. We both agree.
Biden speaking moments ago in a joint news conference with visiting German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Questions surface about Berlin's commitment to supporting NATO's response in light of its energy pipeline deal with Moscow. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. and Europe are working to protect energy markets in case the conflict over Ukraine upends supplies.
Secretary Blinken says the U.S. wants to make sure European energy supplies are protected if the Russian government turns off the spigot or sends troops into Ukraine, which would result in U.S. and EU sanctions. The European Union's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, says Europe is preparing for the worst.
We are living, to my understanding, the most dangerous moment for the security in Europe after the end of the Cold War. But at the same time, we believe that there is still room for diplomacy.
The EU diplomat is urging Russia to negotiate and pull back troops now massed on Ukraine's border. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Democratic governors of New Jersey and Delaware say they're planning to end their statewide masking requirements inside schools and child care centers next month. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong has more.
Delaware's requirement is set to end on March 31st, and New Jersey's Governor Phil Murphy is lifting his state's mandate on March 7th. Murphy says the state is making the change because infection rates among students and educators have been declining.
Any student, educator, or staff member, or visitor who chooses to continue masking up while indoors may freely do so. And we expect that schools will take swift disciplinary action against those who may try to demean or bully anyone who chooses to wear a mask.
The National Academy for State Health Policy says more than a dozen states currently have masking requirements for K through 12 schools. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
While Omicron variant caseloads nationwide are down 50% from 2 weeks ago, the coronavirus is still claiming about 2,400 U.S. lives each day. On NPR's Here and Now, Dr. Michael Osterholm, one of the country's leading epidemiologists, addresses lagging indicators in some areas.
10 to 15 states right now that are still seeing the major impact, what we call lagging indicators of those peaks. People are still hospitalized and unfortunately dying at a very increased rate yet. And that will continue for a few more weeks in these locations.
Dr. Osterholm directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. This is NPR News.
NPR News es presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Kodiak's first shipment of N95 masks from the federal government has arrived and will freely be available at the Safeway supermarket. Although, as KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports, supply is limited of the paper masks that boast increased protection from airborne viruses.
The Biden administration announced last month that 400 million N95 masks would be going to pharmacies and community health centers across the country. In Kodiak, Safeway, off Mill Bay Road, received 4,000 N95 masks on Wednesday night. Safeway staff said people would be able to pick them up for free by Thursday afternoon. Mask distribution at the store will be self-served, but that doesn't mean it's a free-for-all. The federal government outlined 3 N95s per household as part of its free mask rollout. And Safeway staff say they're unsure if and when they'll receive another shipment, so it's important for people to take only what they need. Pharmacies participating in the free N95 rollout are the same ones that partnered with the federal government to provide COVID-19 vaccines to the public. Safeway was the only location to receive free N95 masks on Kodiak Island. The CDC has recommended N95 masks over cloth ones to help prevent the spread of the Omicron variant of the virus, which has caused case numbers across the country to surge, including on Kodiak Island. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Alaska's congressional delegation made a unique appearance before state lawmakers on Friday and told them that the state benefited a lot from the recently passed federal infrastructure law. Representative Don Young defended the law against Republican critics. He says it will send Alaska $6,000 per resident for transportation infrastructure, the most of any state.
Some people within the state don't think this is a good deal. Try something without it. I keep telling people, just keep in mind, I had people tell me, well, we could do better when we're in control. Well, that's nonsense.
Young and Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan testified by video conference before the State House Labor and Commerce Committee. Young proposed that legislators work with the delegation in a joint oversight committee to ensure that Alaska projects are funded and built in a timely manner. Murkowski says it was unique for the delegation to speak to a state legislative committee, and it showed how unprecedented the law is. She was part of a small bipartisan group of senators who spent last year working on the bill. She says it included benefits for each state, like the Alaska Marine Highway System here.
What we were trying to do was knit together an infrastructure bill that was going to be good for all of America, including those of us in the far north.
Sullivan says he opposed pieces of the bill, but that overall it will help Alaska. He also says it was similar to a bill former President Donald Trump's administration supported. Sullivan says the estimated $1.5 billion in broadband funding for Alaska is significant.
We get some of the biggest amounts of federal funding for broadband of any state in the country, not per capita, straight-up broadband funding.
The infrastructure coordinator for Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration says the state is determining what infrastructure spending can be proposed during the legislative session, which must end by May 18th. The state's eligibility for other funding won't be clear until after the session. Senator Lisa Murkowski has endorsed President Biden's commitment to pick an African-American woman for the Supreme Court, and suggests she'll cross the aisle to confirm a highly qualified nominee. In a rare appearance on a Sunday talk show, Murkowski told host Jake Tapper of CNN's State of the Union that the court should reflect the country.
I want to make sure that the president nominates an exceptional candidate, an exceptional individual. And I would be honored to be able to support an exceptional African-American woman.
The Alaska Republican appeared on the show with Senator Joe Manchin, a West Virginia Democrat. They are among the Senate's few moderates, senators who sometimes vote against their party on important matters. Tapper invited them to talk about bipartisan cooperation. Supporting Biden's approach to filling the court vacancy sets Murkowski apart from the other Republicans. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas calls Biden's pledge to nominate a black woman, quote, offensive, close quote. Murkowski says she wants Biden to pick someone who will appeal to senators of both parties.
There are many, many exceptionally well-qualified African-American women who could move forward into this position. So, Mr. President, I'm asking you to look through those critically and not pick the one that would be to the furthest left.
Murkowski is running for re-election this year, and Manchin on Sunday announced his endorsement. But it's not clear that will win her many votes. Progressives are mad at Manchin for blocking Biden's Build Back Better bill. The Alaska Republican Party has already endorsed a conservative challenger, Kelly Chewbacca, who has the support of former President Donald Trump. Murkowski campaign manager Nate Adams says Manchin's endorsement shows she will work with senators of any party to advance Alaska's priorities. For the second year in a row, the Yukon Quest will not run the traditional 1,000-mile race between Fairbanks and Whitehorse, Yukon Territory. This year, there are four shorter events, two in Alaska and two in the Yukon. The longest race covers 350 miles, running from Fairbanks to Central and beyond, and then heading back to Fairbanks. Among a small group of mushers registered to run the 350 is Brent Sass, a three-time Quest champion known for his positive energy. Lex Trinan has this report.
It's 10 in the morning, and musher Brent Sass is feeding his dogs after a midnight training run in the White Mountains. It's just a couple of days before the start of the Yukon Quest.
There you go, sister. Oh.
38 of his dogs are chained up around his bear property in the Goldstream Valley in Fairbanks. Most are scarfing down the beef stew hungrily from their bowls that are caked in ice. After eating, they quickly curl up into their straw beds. But 42-year-old Sass is still energetic after the hours-long run in negative double-digit temperatures and hours on the road.
I work on a 24-hour clock, and so there's no daylight or daytime or nighttime or anything. It's always just whenever I feel like going out or when I have the time.
Sass says he lives on 4 hours of sleep per day. For most of the other 20, he's working, shoveling snow, breaking trail, chopping wood, or any of the other chores it takes to keep his 50-dog kennel healthy and his homestead intact. That boundless energy has helped propel Sass's wild and free team to back-to-back 1,000-mile quest wins in 2019 and 2020, and his best-ever Iditarod finish last year. This year, he's excited to get back on the quest trail and says his team is stronger than ever.
The team is a little bit shaken up this year. I have a lot of young dogs that are kicking out some of those older guys.
But the musher himself has also improved, and he has eyes on an even bigger goal, winning the Iditarod.
My self-discipline has gotten a lot better over the last few years, and so I feel like, you know, if I can follow those standards, I have a really good shot at being up there in the front, at least with a shot.
Despite his age advantage, the last year hasn't been a joyride. And no, this isn't another story about how the pandemic upturned another life. A month before last year's Iditarod start, Sass broke his collarbone in a crash. After a surgery 2 weeks until the start, he managed to finish third behind Dallas Stevie and Aaron Burmeister. This winter, the biggest challenge was the elements, combined with not having any of his handlers at his large, remote homestead off the Elliott Highway. Snowfall in November was intense.
I'd go out, break trail for a day and a half straight, come home, do two runs, and it'd snow a foot on top of that. And then go and do it again, and because I didn't have a choice. You know, if I wanted to keep miles on the dogs, I had to do it.
Just as he was feeling overwhelmed, a former handler from Norway showed up to lend a hand, along with a succession of wild and free friends and fans. His next challenge was more sentimental, moving his kennel temporarily out of his home of the last 15 years to a plot in Goldstream Valley where he'll be closer to racing.
This is the first time ever I've shut the homestead down.
With the help of his dad, Sass moved most of his dogs to this bare plot surrounded by spruce. His 12 by 12 foot cabin is pretty Spartan by most standards.
Usually all my clothes are on, but usually all the clothes are hanging on the wall, but it's a small.
There's
small
little more than a couch, like I said, a mattress, and a few pots and pans.
Oh, I miss home badly, but it's fun to be here, and this will make, I know that in the end, this makes my logistics much easier, and so like that's in the back of my head.
So far, the move looks to be paying off. Last month, he cruised to a decisive win in the Copper Basin 300, posting the fastest run times for each leg. The Copper Basin was run in bitterly cold weather, but with hard, fast trail, something that he doesn't get much of in his homestead. Still, Sass says that was the easy part.
I got there and I was like, all I have to do is take care of these 12 dogs for the next 50 hours? Like, that's easy.
Sass says he'll take that attitude into the 350-mile quest this weekend, but with his eyes set on the Iditarod in March. In Fairbanks, I'm Lex Trinan.
Well, front runners in the Yukon Quest 350 are more than halfway through this year's Out and Back race trail. Mushers started in Fairbanks on Saturday, headed out to Two Rivers, Mile 101, Central, and beyond, and the leaders are now retracing that route. Matt Hall and Brent Sass were the first to leave the Central checkpoint earlier this morning for the climb back over Eagle Summit toward Mile 101. Meanwhile, Dan Caduce arrived in Central to take first place in the Quest 200. A winter weather advisory remains in effect for blowing snow over Eagle Summit, where poor conditions kept some middle and back of the pack teams still headed out the trail, pinned down on the other side at Mile 101 checkpoint. Lex Trinan has this report.
It's Sunday morning and teams are steadily pulling into the checkpoint at Mile 101 of the Peak Highway. The stop itself is hardly more than a parking lot with a souped-up Connex with snacks, but most mushers are excited for whatever comfort they can get after their last monster run. The 70 miles from Two Rivers up and over Rosebud Summit are considered by many mushers to be the hardest stretch of trail. Still, veteran musher Rob Cook from Yukon says the run was pretty straightforward compared to what he's experienced in the past.
There was blowing snow coming across, but it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be from the noise it was making before. So
others behind him had a little bit tougher as light, fluffy snow started to pile up. Justin Olness is running the 200-miler.
It was very tough.
He said snow was soft and punched through by moose hooves on the stretch of the trail near the Chena River. Then, as he approached 12-mile summit, another test of the trail after Rosebud, he had one of his biggest dogs get injured. He had to throw it in the sled.
Having to push that extra weight up 12-mile summit. It's a very steep climb. And then tough going, and then a very fast descent.
That was followed by 15 miles of slogging through soft snow on the river valley next to the Steese Highway into Mile 101.
If you think about running through sand, running through soft snow is kind of similar.
Huslia musher DJ Starr's problems started not with his dogs, but with his own body. For one, pushing the sled up the steep hill wasn't something the Flatlander is used to on his stomping grounds around the Koyukuk River.
I was working and then I started cramping. And then when the dogs needed me the most, I was not 100%.
Star's side cramps slowed progress, letting a couple of his males pick up the scent of females in heat.
I actually had on-the-trail breeding, so they were stuck by it for 30 minutes together.
The horny dogs got tangled up repeatedly in the middle of the climb.
I'm running uphill to straighten them out, and then they do it again and again and again. I probably lost at least an hour and a half to 2 hours on that run.
Still, he says he got into 101 feeling better than he had last year during his first attempt at the quest. He says he'll be thrilled if he can finish the 200-miler this year. There's plenty of race ahead of him, though. After leaving 101, teams dashed up Eagle Summit. The descent towards Central is known as one of the most treacherous sections of the entire trail. 350 musher Cody Straith says mushers need to do their best to stay in control of their sleds on the harrowing descent.
You're like standing on the brake and it's hitting bumps and you're bouncing and you're going way too fast. And it's also side hill, so the sled feels like it's going to tip on you.
The section is often windswept, exposing jagged rocks that have claimed many a dog sled over the years. This year, the heavy snow had covered up most of the rocks, sparing the sled runners on Straith's sled, but it took a toll on the musher himself. After navigating down the climb, Straith says his shoulder was too tender to use, and he had to navigate the windy 15 miles into Central with just one arm.
I kept going off the trail down here and couldn't control my sled, and it took me a long time to get in just because I didn't have use of my left arm because it's so hurt so bad.
He made it into the checkpoint in fourth place, but decided to withdraw from the race in Central. Still, his quest isn't exactly over. He's sticking around to support a musher in the 200-mile race who's running his team of dogs. Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Central, I'm Lex Trinan.
Law enforcement officials shot and killed a man in Aniak on Friday. Alaska State Troopers say that's after the man shot and wounded a U.S. Marshal while they were trying to arrest him. KYUK's Olivia Eberts has this report.
Alaska State Troopers called U.S. Marshals to Aniak. They wanted backup for what they called a high-risk arrest. 34-year-old Andrew John Jr. had been wanted on one felony assault charge since late January. The officers attempted the arrest on Friday. According to troopers, as they searched John's home, John shot and wounded a U.S. deputy marshal. The officers evacuated the wounded marshal, exited the house, and surrounded it. When John stepped outside, multiple officers shot at him and killed him. They pronounced him dead on the scene. The wounded marshal was taken to the Aniak Sub-Regional Clinic and then medevaced to a hospital in Anchorage, where he's in stable condition. Troopers say John was carrying a loaded shotgun when he came out of his house. Troopers would not describe how John was holding the shotgun or how many bullets it contained, saying that information is part of an ongoing investigation by the Alaska State Troopers Bureau of Investigation. A spokesperson for the Alaska State Troopers said he was not aware if the troopers or the U.S. Marshals were wearing body cameras at the time of the incident. Troopers did not respond to a question asking why the arrest was considered high risk. John was wanted on one felony charge of assault in the third degree. He was not charged with assaulting someone, but of causing fear that he would assault or harm another person. He was also wanted on one misdemeanor count of violating his conditions of release. Interim Mayor of Aniak, Dave Cannon, said that the shooting was a, quote, unfortunate incident. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
Insight Daily Radio. The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic, is a groundbreaking new book that examines the phenomenon of mass shootings in America and an urgent call to implement evidence-based strategies to stop these tragedies. Frustrated by reactionary policy conversations, the authors, special investigator and psychologist Jill Peterson and sociologist James Densley, built the Violence Project, the first comprehensive database of mass shooters to establish the root causes of mass shootings and figure out how to stop them. We spoke with them about this most important book.
We discovered in our research the fact that mass shootings, in addition to being homicides, they're almost always suicides, which is not something that I had thought about. But when a perpetrator goes in, they don't go in with an escape route. They don't go in with a plan to race for the border. They go in intending this to be their final act.
And so the idea is, if this is the final act, it changes the way we think about mass shootings, because if we approach them more like suicides than we do homicides, we would intervene really differently. And if you recognize that people are struggling and that's what gets them to that point, it moves us closer again to that prevention, which is really what we're emphasizing in the book.
The trajectory of mass shootings over time and how they've been increasing steadily over the last 20 years, it maps on almost perfectly to these increases in suicides and other forms of deaths of despair.
That's special investigator and psychologist Jill Peterson and sociologist James Densley, the authors of The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic, which has just been released.
Insight Daily Radio.
A housing needs assessment survey is coming soon to Kodiak. Help your community by participating in the survey, which may come by mail or via a phone call. Responses are anonymous and will be incorporated in a housing needs assessment document that will be available to the public. Those who complete the survey will be entered in a prize drawing happening each week in February. This message is sponsored by Kodiak Island Housing Authority.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the seventh day of February, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 8:58. It won't set again until 5:49. That will give us 8 hours and 52 minutes of daylight. a gain of 4 minutes and 38 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high for this date was 48, set in 1982, and a record low was minus 1, set in 43 and 93. Currently 30 degrees out at the airport, 32 here at the station. They are calling for snow and freezing fog at the airport. And that snow is expected to go until 4 p.m., followed by rain and snow. High near 35 today with light and variable winds, turning to the east to 20, could gust as high as 30. More rain and snow tonight, too, turning to all rain after 7 p.m. So that should be nice. Low around 33, south winds to 10, becoming west to 25. Winds could gust as high as 30. Little or no snow accumulation tonight, but we're talking about 1 or 2 inches piling up today, and that certainly seems to be happening. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming up on the east side right now. It's going to happen in 1 minute and be 1.7 feet, followed by a high tide at 6:22 this evening of 5.8 feet. Our next low tide will be at 12:02 a.m., just after midnight, and be 2.3 feet. And our high tide for tomorrow morning here on the east side will happen at 6:39 a.m. and be 7.9 feet. Over on the west side, you have a low tide coming up at 12:57 p.m., just about 1 o'clock. That will be a 2.8-foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a high tide at 6:48. That will be a 10-foot tide. Your next low tide will be at 12:36 a.m. and be 3.8 feet. And your high tide for tomorrow morning on the west side will happen at 7:05 a.m. and be 12.5 feet. Mariners, here's your forecast for Monument Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side offshore. Small craft advisory through Tuesday. For today, south winds to 20, becoming east 30 by this afternoon. Seas to 11 feet. For tonight, southwest 30, seas coming up to 15 feet. And for tomorrow, west winds to 30 knots, becoming southwest 20, seas remaining at 15 feet. Tomorrow night on our east side, southeast 35, seas to 18 feet. Those conditions expected to continue through Wednesday. In the Shelikof Strait, we have a gale warning tonight and Tuesday and a heavy freezing spray warning tonight and Tuesday. For tonight, northeast 30, becoming northwest 40 after midnight, seas to 10 feet with freezing spray, heavy freezing spray after midnight in the Shelikof tonight. For tomorrow, southwest 35, diminishing to 25 knots late, seas to 10 feet, heavy freezing spray in the morning in the Shelikof. And for Tuesday night, northeast 30, seas to 9 feet. Kodiak History Museum's new exhibit, Making History Day by Day, Kodiak, Our Stories and the COVID-19 Pandemic, is now on view at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium Foyer. The exhibit is available at no cost to the public through February 23rd. It's a reflection on the COVID experience in Kodiak, and the exhibit features art, stories, photos, and more from you. KHM will also be hosting a drop-in activity at the Auditorium Foyer on February 12th, from 1 to 4 p.m., complete with activities and door prizes. Contact the curator, Lynn Walker, at curator@kodiakhistorymuseum.org with any questions. There will be a Board of Education work session tonight, immediately followed by a special meeting. That's happening at 6:30 p.m., and both meetings will be conducted virtually through BlueJeans. Meeting login information is posted on the Kodiak Island Borough School District website. That's at www.kibsd.org. For more information, contact Bianca Clark at 907-486-7566. The Kodiak City Council will be holding a work session tomorrow. The meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. They will also be having a regular meeting on Thursday, also at 7:30 p.m. Public members are encouraged to tune in right here on KMXT at 100.1 FM. The meetings will also be web-streamed, and the web-streaming link and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. For those who wish to request printed meeting materials or have questions, contact the clerk at 486-8636. Kodiak Island Borough meeting's coming up. Tomorrow, the local emergency planning committee is having a meeting. That's happening virtually at 1 p.m. On Wednesday also, 6:30 p.m., the Planning and Zoning Commission will be having a work session. And on Thursday, the Assembly will be having their work session at 6:30 p.m., also virtually. All these virtual meetings can be viewed online at the Kodiak Island Borough website. That's at www.kodiakak.us.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181. Fax us at 486-2733 or email psa@kmxt.org.